I found the assignment a little intimidating. Just the thought of commenting on something that David had written. I mean, David's the master psalmist, the master songwriter, and to think of commenting in, you know, just the thought of improving on something like that, it's not possible. But it did bring me back to the little anecdote I told you yesterday about how they taught the rabbis to teach. And for those of you that weren't here, the teaching of the rabbis were instructed to tell a series of very short stories. And this was an attempt to keep the audience engaged. So they would never talk on one subject or one theme for a long time. They'd do a little bit, then go to the next one, the next one. And the Hebrew word for speaking is shaarz. It's C-H-A-R-Z. And that means a string of beads or pearls. Now, whether it's beads or pearls depends on the speaker. Yesterday I told you something about John's pearls. Today we're going to talk about beads. My beads. So, in thinking of this, and you know, I actually tried to get out of the assignment. I went to my good friend, I thought he was my good friend, Tom Ricciarello, and I said, I think you have the theme in Jackson. He says, no, I have the Vesper service. I said, look, I'll take the Vesper service, you take the theme. And guess what he said?
No.
It's the end of a beautiful friendship. Okay, so here's what I have. As I pondered this incredible scripture, the psalm, and the song, Psalm 120, is an incredible presentation of the entire psalm. I had a few thoughts. The string of beads again. And I've got 12 or 14 thoughts, and they're not necessarily connected. And some of them are better than others. So, here we go. Number one. The first thing we can say about this psalm is that it's an illustration. And illustrations, stories, parables, these are all very effective teaching techniques. And I'm sure there isn't a teacher around that doesn't resort to an illustration. At least for two reasons. An illustration gets you to the point where you can make this one point. I want to make this perfectly clear. Let me give you an illustration of it. And the second part of it is, I think, that it's a simplification. That's what's nice about an illustration. It's a simplification. The other thing it allows us to do is that frequently we're trying to teach or discuss unseen concepts, ideas. And we need something physical to relate to. So the teacher takes something physical and says, it's a little bit like this. And so we use the Old Testament. The New Testament are filled with illustrations, parables, stories. Jesus was the master of the parable. Sometimes the illustration is crystal clear, and sometimes it's not that clear, and we struggle with it. What does he really mean? This Psalm 91 is filled with illustrations. Now, I might say that illustrations also have limitations. They don't say it all, and if you take the illustration too far, you're going to lose the point. We've been asked to focus on Psalm 91, actually just one verse of Psalm 91, but I think to understand it, we must look at the whole psalm. So we'll go to our second point, and that's the illustrative objects in Psalm 91. It's a collection of words. I'm going to list some of the words for you and see if patterns come to your mind. Shelter, shadow, fortress, snare, pestilence, feathers, wings, shield, rampart, terror, arrow, pestilence, plague, tent, stone, lion, cobra. I wish we had time to go around and ask, what came to your mind as you heard these words? Well, as I went through this multiple times, there was the good news, bad news. Maybe it was more bad news and then some good news. Words like fortress, shield, rampart, arrow, this is terminology of warfare. Those are some pretty tough words. We see other words of great danger, potentially fatal concepts. Pestilence, it says deadly pestilence, terror of night, plagues, lions, cobras, snakes, serpents, also snares. What's a snare? A snare is a trap that has been set. A snare looks like something else, but it's really to entangle you. These are problems. So a lot of these words, I would suggest, in this psalm, David's talking about bad things. He's talking about some terrible happenings. But the good news is that this psalm is not just a lamentation about bad things, bad events, bad things that happen to you and to me. It's also presented, that's just an introduction to a remedy, to an incredible remedy. And when we hear words like shelter, dwelling, and tent, these are warm words. These make us feel safe. Now, this is an expression of David's mind. This is an expression of what David went through. We tend to speak from our own experience. And we know his life well. He had problems. He had lots of problems. He had all kinds of problems. When he's looking for a fortress, as in some cases he was looking for a literal fortress. This was not just poetry. Which leads me to the next concept, and that is that this is an Old Testament story. Now that we live in New Testament times, can we forget about these things? So, point number three, let's go see if this preliminary concept that I've presented is supported or confirmed in the New Testament. Well, you know the answer. We don't have to look too far. Jesus said in John 16:33, in this world you will have trouble. You will have trouble. He says it right out there. And I like Matthew 10:25. He says, it's enough for the student to be like the teacher. We're going to get the same kind of trouble Jesus did. And in a very personal sense, Luke 22:31, Simon, Simon, Satan has asked to sift you like wheat. And the story is told in Revelation, the 12th chapter, verse 17. Then the dragon was enraged at the woman and went off to make war against the rest of her offspring. And if you have any doubt who the rest of her offspring are, the Revelator, it continues, it says, those who obey God's commandments and hold to the testimony of Jesus. I hope that applies to you. I hope that second part, that you obey God's command and hold to the testimony of Jesus, applies to you. And if it does, you see what the first part says, that that's something Satan hates. So the New Testament confirms repeatedly that following Jesus brings a lot of attention, negative attention, and it brings conflict. All the troubles that were alluded to in the Old Testament are confirmed in the New Testament. Number four. What's the worst problem mentioned in this psalm? Well, what's the worst word? Again, we would probably each come up with something different depending on our experience. I came to the conclusion that the worst word in this psalm is serpent, because this represents the adversary. Close second is the lion, as in the roaring lion in 2 Peter. And potentially, this is the scariest word. The serpent. This is a big force, but this is an old force. Think of how old the force of Satan is. This is, I'm going to say, millions of years old. This is an old problem. So, David talks about this. In this psalm, he says, one of your problems is going to be the serpent. And I would say that that means unseen forces. Specifically, your adversary, the devil. This is not a Bible story. This is not just an illustration. We're done. The serpent's the illustration. Satan is for real. Ephesians 6:12. Our struggle is not against flesh and blood, but against the rulers, against the authorities, against the powers of this dark world, and against spiritual forces of evil in the heavenly realms. I think it's pretty much like the great story in Job. You know how Job starts out in the first chapter. In verse 6, one day the angels came to present themselves before Jehovah. And Satan also came with them. And Jehovah said to Satan, "Where have you come from?" Satan answered the Lord, "From roaming through the earth and going back and forth in it." Then the Lord said to Satan, "Have you considered my servant Job? There was no one on earth like him. He is blameless and upright, a man who fears God and shuns evil." Verse 9, Satan replies, "Does Job fear God for nothing? Have you not put a hedge around him?" You have a hedge around you. You think Satan likes that hedge? No. And I think that kind of conversation, to some degree, I know this is poetry, this is a story, but I think to some degree that kind of conversation has taken place, generally speaking, about you and me. James is one of the first to admit that there are demons. He says, "You believe there is one God. Good, even the demons believe that." James believed in demons. And like that battle in Revelation that we alluded to, there are these forces that have existed for thousands of years. Thousands of years. This very day, that seek your personal demise as a Christian. There are personalities in this universe that are in great conflict with God's plans and purposes. Their goal has always been to thwart God's plan, and you know that there was a seed of promise. And you know how Satan has worked through the ages to divert the seed of promise, to destroy the seed of promise. You're still the seed of promise. He's bringing all his force and focus on you. This is a formidable foe. And if it were us against him, we wouldn't stand a chance. But, point number five. It's good news. It's alluded to in this psalm, but I'm going to quote from Romans 8:38. "I am convinced that neither death nor life, neither angels nor demons, will be able to separate us from the love of God. And one of the nice things about Psalm 91, verse 11, very clearly says, He will command His angels concerning you to guard you in all your ways. Does that make the battle even? No. Once we get the angel forces on our side, it's no contest. It's no contest. This too is not a Bible story. This is not an illustration. This is real. Matthew 18:10, Jesus was teaching one day, and He had the little children around Him, and He was telling the listeners that in heaven, their angels always behold the face of My Father. Even so, in verse 14 says, Even so, it is not the will of My Father who is in heaven that one of these little ones should perish. And it's interesting because virtually the entire Bible is written against a backdrop of unseen forces and the physical earth and its inhabitants. There have always been this arena just on the other side of the veil. Angels. Doesn't matter if it was in Noah's day, Abraham's day, Hagar, Elisha. Elisha, the angels were there. And David says in Psalm 34, the angel of the Lord encampeth round about them that fear Him. And of course we come back to this Psalm of 91, verse 11, and the power of God is not just a poof, it's exerted through instruments and through agents. I like to quote very much regarding guardian angels from Brother Hudson in the Bible Study Monthly some years back. He was discussing whether each one of us has an angel. And of course, my personal opinion has always been that I had three because I get into so much trouble, I must be able to keep three of them busy. And Brother Hudson says, it's more likely that all the hosts of heaven are instantly available for service in the guardianship of those on earth. I like that even better than my three. He says, this does not imply a blanket protection against all conceivable human ills and accidents, but the powers of heaven are available so to modify and divert circumstances having a direct bearing upon our Christian life and progress. Romans 8:28. And I think it was Elisha who said, greater is He that is for us than all those that can be against us. We do not fight this battle alone, unseen by our natural eyes, but close by our sides, nevertheless, stand the mighty hosts of heaven. Okay, let's bounce back, number six, to a problem. We said that there are problems in the spiritual realm. Well, it's only fair then to look at the non-spiritual realm, and that would be people. The second category of people that emanates from this psalm to me, from David, are people problems. David had a lot of people problems. You know, he started out great as a teenager. As a teenager, I think he was a national hero. He was quickly elevated into the king's court. He was a personal aide to the king and not a servant. He was not a slave or a servant, but he was very prominent, highly respected. Everybody liked him. Everybody liked him. He was popular. And then very quickly it changed. In short order, it just all fell apart. He found himself a fugitive. He was living in a cave instead of the palace. He virtually had armies pursuing him. He must have said many times, what did I ever do to deserve this? The arrows in this psalm, the fortress, the shield, the ramparts, he saw all those things. And some of his other psalms, 38, 19, And 20, many are those who are my vigorous enemies. Those who hate me without reason are numerous. Psalm 56:2, my slanderers pursue me all day long. Psalm 59, fierce men conspire against me for no offense or sin of mine. I have done no wrong, yet they are ready to attack me. So this isn't necessarily Satan. That's that first problem. These are humans, perhaps influenced by Satan. And I alluded yesterday to Galatians 4:29, which I think is a huge concept. And this is where Paul says, in discussing that the problems between Isaac and Ishmael, that he who was born according to the flesh persecuted him who was born according to the Spirit. And Paul says, it happened in his day, and it still happens. Jesus said, a man's enemies will be the members of his own household. But let's quickly get off of that problem, and let's get to a solution. And number 7 is the solution for this people problem. And in a very general sense, David addresses it. And we will get to that, but actually I've got that for number 9 and 10. And I would just say here as an aside, with no disrespect to David, David's going to give us a great solution. But as far as David is concerned himself, we have something even better than David had. Because we have Jesus Christ. And we also have the record of his life and his teachings. We also have the New Testament. I would say that half the New Testament is dealing with people problems. Hebrews 12:3. And this is our watchword. Consider him who endured such opposition from sinful men, so that you will not grow weary and lose heart. You know, sometimes I think, boy, it's really tough to suffer through these people who aren't very smart. And then I think of Jesus. Oh my gosh. What a genius he was compared to mankind. And he suffered through living with those, I want to say morons, but I have to find a better word. So I know Brother Lagno's probably got his thesaurus going already, and he'll come up with a word for me. And another great solution for the people problem for me is the manna text for December 13th. I have such a problem in this area that I have memorized this text, this comment. I try to say this to myself every day to calm myself down. How great a blessing it would be for all spiritual Israelites to learn well this lesson, namely, that if we accept the results of any experience as being good, and that we were guided to those results by divine providence, we should think and feel most kindly, most graciously to those who were the instruments used by providence. Do you realize what that just said? Is that when somebody comes up and attacks you, you have to thank God for the educational experience you just received. And the comment goes out. Notwithstanding the fact that they may have been unwilling instructors, or like Joseph's brethren, even intended the opposite results. Those who are unable to take such a view of the affairs and forces operating in their daily lives are enabled, quote, always to triumph in the Lord, unquote, as the apostle expresses it. And such find no room for bitterness or railing, either against Satan or his servants. That's the end of the quote. I kind of like the fact that Brother Russell there acknowledged that Satan has servants around us. And of course, David has the big solution, the big picture solution, the source of all solutions, my God in whom I trust. Surely he will save you from the fowler's snare. That's verse 2 and 3. But that's the big solution. So I want to go on to number 8, which is another problem. Okay? Very briefly. And this is a different kind of problem because it works differently. It's a different process. We've got the unseen, we've got the seen, those around us, but then we have another phenomenon that moves through groups of people. That's what I get out of David's references to plagues and pestilences. This is not a person. This is like an invasion of, well, in David's day, you know, it was probably an invasion of mass infection. It was probably some sort of bacteria or something. They thought in those days leprosy, this is an epidemic of contagious disease that could wipe out large parts of society, entire villages. And we know that in our world the threat still exists, especially outside this country. But we would say, well, let's look for spiritual plagues. Let's look for spiritual pestilences. And we know that in this country, the federal government has a center for disease control. It's called the CDC. I think headquarters are in Atlanta. And they watch for things like flu. They look for swine flu. They look for the Asian bird flu. HIV is big to these people. And you know what their definition of an epidemic is? What the percentage of population that has to be affected before they call it an epidemic? It's like, why are they worried about this number? They're worried about this number because when they think that when it gets beyond this number, it spreads so fast, multiplies geometrically, that you can't control it. So you know what their percentage is? Boy, if you haven't seen this somewhere else, you'd never guess what their percentage is. To define an epidemic, it's 1%. If 1% of a population has a disease, they consider it an epidemic. You know what HIV is in Washington, D.C.? It's 3%. They're worried about it. 1%. And you can see that if you translate that to the United States, that's 2-3 million people. So they don't want something like that to get out of control where there's nothing that can be done about it. So, you know, I have a pretty wild imagination. And so going to the spiritual application, I say there must be some epidemics, there must be some plagues affecting the Bible students. Right? This is a real world. It only takes 1%. Do we have some phenomenon in our society that's more than 1%? Well, I did some research. I'm not going to tell you whether it was the East Coast research or West Coast research. But I saw a number. It's over 1% of idol worship. 1% of the Bible student population is inflicted with idol worship. That's what the research said. Materialism, it was up to 10%, but with this economy, it dropped down to 5%. But it's still epidemic. Lack of spiritual growth, lack of direct Bible study. I heard some encouraging statistics on that this weekend. How about the numbers for sectarianism? I think they're pretty high. I think it's a plague. It's a pestilence. It could get out of control. Okay, enough on that. Number 9, solutions from Psalm 91, from David's picture. Let's go back to that. And we acknowledge how David's life, boy, he had problems. He had people after him. He had his own internal demons, you might say. He had his, whether you call them hormones or whatever, gosh, he was just... He struggled so much. How does he cope? What is so nice about Psalm 91? There isn't a hint of depression or self-pity in Psalm 91. And that's an easy place to go. And as we look at our theme scripture, and I want to compliment the calligraphy, it kind of has two parts. And the second part, which I want to address first, is his truth shall be his shield and buckler. And I don't want to make a big deal out of this, but probably a more accurate translation would be his faithfulness. In this particular verse, he's not talking about truth as a list of doctrines. He's not saying, you know, it's the ransom, it's the second presence, it's restitution, that's what your shield and buckler. We kind of resonate with that. And that's a good thought, but that's not what it's really saying here. This word means God's honesty. His faithfulness. If you look at the other translations, like New American, NIV, it says his faithfulness. The fact that when he says something, it's going to happen, that's what your shield is. Now, knowledge will disappear someday, but not God's faithfulness. Okay, the next one, and I think I'm up to number 10. And this is the crux of it. This is the one that gives us great confidence. He will cover you with his feathers, and under his wings you will find refuge. Now remember, it's an illustration. It's not literal. So let me tell you my imaginations about this illustration, okay? What David's trying to illustrate here is how much Jehovah protects us in the face of any kind of problem. Unseen, seen, pestilences, internal demons, external demons, Jehovah is there. So what does he use to illustrate this? It's a bird protecting its offspring. What I found interesting is that it's a male bird. He will. His feathers, his wings. This is not a hen. This is not a barnyard scene of a plump chicken. I picture a fighting bird. This is a hawk. This is a mean hawk, a fighting eagle. Fierce protection of the nest. Totally protecting the young birds. Sharp beak, talons, ready to fend off any attack. Incidentally, you know what the biggest predator of a bird is? Other birds. Think about that one. Don't have time for that. But I don't know if you've ever seen a bird fight. But there's nothing halfway about it. I've seen birds fight. And they're just, I want to say like they're out of their mind. They're just totally consumed. They don't fight a little bit and back off and see what the other thing's going to do. They just go wild. And you know, when it talks about wings and feathers, you know what the wingspan of an eagle is? Like a golden eagle? 6 to 8 feet. We're not talking little chicken wings. We're talking eagle wings. That's the kind of protection that you get. I was wondering if there were other wings in the New Testament. Not much. I think I only found 3 references to wings, and they're all in Revelation. There's one, Revelation 4:8, talked about the wings under the 4 living creatures and how they all had eyes. And to me that says, you know, wings mean wisdom. They can see all directions. There are wings of pure strength, and that's in Revelation 9, where they had breastplates of iron, and the sound of their wings, they had to be strong wings, if there's breastplates of iron. And then in Revelation 12 again, the woman was given two wings of a great eagle, and these were wings of escape. So sometimes the wings are wisdom, sometimes they're strength, and sometimes they allow you to flee. I think the picture has another facet, while we're still on the birds, and that is, this is number 11, that the baby chick, the eaglet or the fledgling, has a responsibility to stay pretty close to the nest. You can picture if all the eaglets are running off in opposite directions, despite the mighty wingspan of the parent, they if they go too far, there's nothing that the eagle can do. So I think there's an idea buried here that says we have to stay close to the parent. We have a responsibility. We just can't do anything and say, you know, Jehovah's going to shield me. No. In this Psalm 91, the concept is there because he says, right in the first verse, he who dwells in the shelter. So you've got to stay in the shelter. You can't take off. Make your Most High your dwelling, verse 9. And he quotes Jehovah in verse 14. And Jehovah says, because he loves me, I will rescue him. There's a responsibility to love Jehovah. And he says, I will protect him, Jehovah, because he acknowledges my name. Those are your responsibilities. Love, acknowledge his name. 15, he will call upon me and I will answer. You need to choose those things. Those are choices. And at the moment, my best definition of consecration is choices. Are you choiced? Are you making the right decisions? Then you're consecrated. 2 Corinthians 2, verse 11 says, we are not unaware of Satan's schemes, so we can be prepared. 1 Peter 5:8, be self-controlled and be alert. Your enemy, the devil, prowls around like a roaring lion looking for someone to devour. Satan would do anything. He will tempt you with anything to get you out of that seed category. James 4:7, resist the devil and he will flee from you. That is an incredible statement. Despite his age, longevity, power, and evilness, James says if you resist him, he'll leave. That's good. Number 12. I think there's a limitation to this, to the illustration. The eagle illustration. And in this sense, as much as I love the illustration, in this sense, the illustration is that of a parent and an infant. And it's the parent bird, the infant chicks. And it's kind of a parent-child, but it's not even a child, it's more of an infant relationship. And my point is that there must come some time in your Christian life where you grow out of being an infant. Right? Maybe it's another illustration, but you've got to grow up someday. I've got to grow up someday. And if you go back to the birds, you know, once a bird matures, it doesn't go running back under its mother's wing or its father's wing. There comes a point in time where the bird has to fight for itself. So that's just an aside. It doesn't lose our main point that Jehovah's always there for us. But the Apostle Paul said in 1 Corinthians 13, verse 11, when I was a child, I spake like a child. I understood as a child. I thought as a child. But when I became a man, I put away childish things. We must move along the pathway to putting away childish things. We acknowledge that we're still always called sons of Jehovah. There's no question that it is a father-child relationship, but it's more of an adult-child relationship when we get to there. And you know that when we grew up, we didn't do away with our dad. When we got into trouble, we still went back to dad. And we knew that that unconditional love would be there, and that wisdom, and that support. And sometimes he'd say to us, "You were wrong." But it was, our relationship became as an adult to our father. Number 13. Are we at 13? I think we're at 13. I should have tested you as we went along, so what number we're at, maybe that would have... And this one, number 13, is a question. Is this battle that we're in, is it all bad? And I don't think so. And the thought that comes to mind here is, in a sense, that you need competition to develop your skills. Any athlete will tell you that you've got to be tested. You've got to have some combat. You've got to have some contests. That's what makes an athlete a champion. There's no such thing as a champion athlete who's never been tested, never been in a contest. The champions are the ones that have won and lost and won more than they lost. And David knows these things. He says, as long as you are in the shelter, you don't have to worry about losing. Verse 9, if you make the Most High your dwelling, verse 10, then no harm will befall you. So the battle's not all that. It's not such a bad thing to be in a battle. 2 Corinthians 4, 8 and 9, we're troubled on every side, yet we're not distressed. We're perplexed, but we're not in despair. Persecuted, but not forsaken. Cast down, not destroyed. All those things because Paul believed he was in the shelter of Jehovah's wings. The last one is a summary. Is that number 13? It's 14. Okay, good. I didn't want to end on 13. That's kind of just a bad number. And I was going to make up another one if we had to. And that is, my last suggestion to you is, you have a responsibility. The scripture's there, yes, but you have a responsibility. You've got to stay close to those wings. You have to stay close to your spiritual father. And if you do that, you have his total protection. And I don't even know how close you have to be. You can scatter away and come back. Father's going to be there. I like the brother yesterday said, the star of the story of the prodigal son is the Father. The Father is going to be there. He will cover you. Nobody messed up more than David. Jehovah will cover you. Amen.